Let's begin. So we had started, we were in the middle of the sixth principle, which is the subject of nevuah, or prophecy, and we explored the Rambam's lengthy description of nevuah, and what we, the conclusion that we had come to in our class last week, if before Purim you can remember anything that went on before Purim, for the benefit of those who are away, the basic chiddush or nuance that we saw in the Rambam was that the Rambam defined prophecy not just in the form of a message or communication, but as an experience, a kind of connection to God, a kind of spiritual experience, and that that spiritual experience can include a message to convey to the people or a message for the individual. It certainly can include a kind of a communication, but it can also be just the experience of connecting to God in some kind of communication or some kind of link that is beyond the normal just dialogue or everyday experience. And we saw at the very end of the class, I showed you one example of where this might be applicable in the context of the story of Abraham and the beginning of Parshat Vayera, where he's sitting out the tent and God comes to him, and the pasuk doesn't say what God said to him. It just says that God appeared to Abraham, and then continues with the rest of the story about Abraham lifting up his eyes and seeing three individuals, and the Mefarshim struggling with the question, what did God say to him? God appeared to him, and then what did he say? And the Ramban's suggestion was that he didn't say anything. He just came to him as a form of spiritual reward, as a kind of indication of the elevated status that Abraham had achieved in the aftermath of the mitzvah of Bris Milah. So that there is a notion of prophecy that goes beyond the utilitarian and message-oriented prophecy, but that is more experiential in terms of a spiritual attainment. That being said, there's also nevuah that is message-oriented, and the examples of nevuah that we have in Tanakh mostly are message-oriented, because that's what the purpose of preserving those nevuot was all about. The nevuah was preserved, recorded, written in a book because it has a message that is of value to the people who are hearing the prophet speak and for the generations to come. We have a notion of nevuah shenitzuchal derot nichtava, that only prophecies that had a message that was beyond just the contextual message, but actually a universal message, those prophecies were recorded in the books of nevuah. So there's certainly both kinds of nevuah that we can talk about, experiential nevuah and message-oriented or purposeful message nevuah. The classic example, or let's say even the paradigmatic example of nevuah that is a message, is the nevuah of Moshe, where the entire nevuah is the Torah as we have it. That is the nevuah of Moshe, and the Rambam will take us to that direction in principle number 7, where he's going to talk at length about the prophecy of Moshe and what made Moshe unique, different than every other Navi. And so he already began to set that up a little bit by talking about characteristics of other Nevi'im that were different from the Nevuah that Moshe experienced, both quantitatively and qualitatively. But the question that I wanted to raise, and I don't know if we actually asked it at the end of the class last week, but we're going to raise it tonight because I think it's really the key issue, is that if Nevuah is message-oriented, if the purpose of the concept that the Rambam is referring to when he talks about this principle of faith is the notion of a message-oriented type of nevuah, then I understand what role it plays in the 13 principles of faith. Namely, that it's a principle of faith to know that God communicates with man so that we can understand that there is a Torah that he has given to us. But the purpose of all of the principles of faith are directed towards establishing the Torah as a binding mandate upon us. And so all of the principles are set up. They really are pre-set up. Right? It's not an accident that the principles are all directed towards a conclusion, which is why they're an introduction to the halacha and to the Yad HaChazaka. The conclusion is the binding nature of the Torah, written and oral, Mishnah, halacha, etc. So I understand the value of the prophecy of Moshe as a principle of faith. But why do I need the notion of prophecy per se, even this kind of experiential-oriented prophecy? What value does it play in the structure of the 13 principles in terms of the mitzvot of the Torah? To know that there is such an experience that Abraham was able to reach, okay, it's very nice, very important, but it's not necessarily part, doesn't necessarily follow in the logical structure of directing me towards a conclusion about the nature of Torah and the binding nature, the binding characteristic of Torah. So one simple solution is, or answer is, that it's a setup, meaning that he wants to talk about the Nevuah of Moshe. So that's really the primary goal. And in order to get us there, first establishes the notion of prophecy as a whole, and then from there we can continue into a discussion of the prophecy of Moshe. So start with Nevuah and move to Nevuah of Moshe. That's a possibility. I would like to suggest that there's another possibility, and that when the Rambam talks about Nevuah, he does so not just as a setup for the next principle, which is the Nevuah of Moshe, but as a standalone value, and that fits into this broader picture. That's what I want to try to discuss. What is the nature of how? What is the structure of where prophecy fits into this picture of the 13 principles, if it's not just a setup to the Nevuah of Moshe? And what we're going to actually do is take a look at a Gemara in Yuma, which is source number 3. This is a really remarkable passage in the Talmud, remarkable for many reasons, not the least being it's a description of idolatry. It actually has very little to do with prophecy, almost nothing to do with prophecy. It all has to do with idolatry. How it links us back to the story of prophecy, we'll see at the end of the shiur today. But what this Gemara is discussing is the phenomenon of the absence of idolatry at the beginning of the Second Temple period. So let me give you a brief introduction, and then we're going to read through this passage in the text. When we discuss, I don't know if we discussed this at all, when we discussed idolatry a couple of principles ago, two principles ago, when we discussed idolatry, we pointed out the fact that idolatry as a cultural force, as a social cultural force, was the predominant force throughout the period of Tanakh. From the time we enter into the land of Israel until the time of the destruction of the first temple, every Navi, with rare exception, almost every Navi in every period of time addresses the fact that we constantly succumb to the temptation of idolatry as it appeared in the cultural context around us. Then the temple is destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. Israel goes into exile to Persia. 70 years later, they come back from this experience in the Babylonian or Persian Empire, and they begin the building of the Second Temple and the establishment of the Second Commonwealth. From that point forward, there's not a single reference to idolatry as a cultural and religious force within our people. We have 3 Nevi'im from the beginning of the Second Temple period, the very beginning. All 3 of them talk about various issues, not about idolatry. It's almost as if it's been taken off the table as an issue of concern for the Nevi'im. We have no record in the entire Second Temple period of a succumbing to the cultural force of idolatry. The closest we get to it is Hanukkah, And a Hanukkah is really a assimilation into Hellenism, which has a certain pagan characteristic to it, but it's very different from classic idolatry. Hellenism was a cultural force of power in society and the role of man. It wasn't as big a theological draw as a classic ancient idolatry. So the question was, what happened in that 70-year period, in that very brief span of 70 years, to essentially eliminate idolatry as a cultural force within our people? It's a remarkable phenomenon because it's such a powerful draw. 1,000 years of idolatry, 70 years of exile, and it's gone. Poof. No more idolatry. What happened to make such a radical change? Now, there are several possibilities. Possibility number one is that we learned our lesson finally. It takes a good pachampanim, destruction of the temple, exile, and we finally learned our lesson. I'm not convinced that that is sufficient enough of an answer, that by in itself is a sufficient answer, because we had many near destruction experiences. Without getting too detailed into the history of Tanakh, between the fall of Shiloh 400 years before the destruction of the temple, or 500 years before the destruction of the temple, was also a radical shake-up for the people of Israel. Periods of history, even when you had a temple, there were certainly periods of near catastrophe because of the idolatrous forces. So it's a partial solution, it's not completely sufficient. Another possibility is that there's something going on socially, historically, that has reduced the power and the draw of idolatry. And that would give us a socio-historical view. Chazal had a third possibility. And it's that third possibility which is the subject of discussion here. Chazal make the suggestion that there was an intentional effort to destroy the drive for idolatry. That there was this dialogue with God over the power of idolatry and the decision to rid ourselves of this cultural and religious force once and for all. And it's that passage that I want to take a look at.
Question.
Yeah.
Do we have any idea why people were so attracted to idolatry?
I'll give you a short answer and a longer answer. The short answer is that it was very rewarding to be able to have a tangible relationship with God. Now, we talked about that a little bit when we studied principle number five. The notion of a tangible connection to God, it's almost impossible to imagine. Even we, who do not, we hope, do not have an idolatrous relationship with God, still have some tangible items that we hang on to, a Sefer Torah, an Aron Kodesh, the Aron. We still have some tangible items that connect us. It's so difficult for us to get our heads around the notion of a completely non-tangible relationship with God. So the simplest draw was the tangibility of it. I think there was a cultural draw to it too. It was a theology that basically said anything you want to do is acceptable. And there were no rules to idolatry. Anything you wanted to do in the name of religion was acceptable. It's a pantheon of gods. And that by and of itself is very attractive. No limitations, no rules, there's no no's, everything's a yes. The third piece of it is that it was most ancient pagan idolatries were also very physically gratifying. They were sexual, they were violent, they spoke to the base animalistic instincts of man and gave them expression. So they were very tangible and very gratifying.
So they replaced movies with idolatry.
Right. Well, they replaced idolatries with movies. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Or worse.
Yeah.
Or worse. The longer answer is essentially this Gemara, which talks about why how we eliminated idolatry by also addressing the fact that what was the draw and why is it so difficult for us to understand what idolatry is all about. So let's take a look. This is a verse, it starts with a verse in Sefer Nehemiah. Nehemiah, there's a description of Ezra Nehemiah is the return from the Babylonian exile. So that's the right time frame. We're talking about the beginning of the Second Temple. There's a description of where he gathers the people together. He builds a big bimo or a big stage, and he has this lengthy description of Jewish history, and he enacts a brit, a covenant with the people to reconnect them to Torah. And there it says, "Vayizaku b'kol gadol el Hashem elokehem." He cried out with a great cry. "My amor," what did they cry? What was going on? "Amara v'item el b'yochanan." This is what they cried. "Bei bei." Bei is like oive. It's just missing the oive, but it's the same idea. Oive, bei bei. "Hainu hai." The achreve le mikdasha. This is it. This is what destroyed the base of mikdash. V'kale le hechale, and destroyed the hechal, the sanctuary. V'katlinu le kule tzadikaya, and murdered, executed all of the righteous. V'aglinu le Yisrael me'ar ehon, and caused Israel to be exiled from their land. What was it that was responsible for the destruction of the temple, the exile of the land, the murder of and the fall of all the righteous? And what was the sin for, that the people succumbed to in the end of the first temple? Avodah Zarah. The adayin mirakid binan, and it is still dancing amongst us. This power, this draw of idolatry. Klum yav telan ela lekabule be'agla. You have given it to us only for one purpose, and that is to receive its reward. Remember that phrase. I'm going to come back to it. What is the reward of idolatry? The simplest explanation is that the reward we get for having idolatry is that you have given it to us only for its reward. Lo iu ba'inan v'lo akne ba'inan. We need neither it nor its reward. We'll forgo the reward. The simplest explanation of what reward we are talking about is, what reward do we get for having idolatry in the world?
The self-gratification from it?
Self-gratification? No. No, on the contrary, the opposite. He's saying that the only reason God created idolatry was so that we could be rewarded for not doing it. Right? So therefore, we're prepared to forgo. We'll forgo the reward and get rid of the idolatry. That's the concept. The question is, what exactly is the reward that the Gemara is referring to? So the simplest explanation is that it is referring to the reward we get for abstaining from the idolatry. By not succumbing to the temptation, we elevate ourselves and we are greater, and therefore we are rewarded for that strength of character. But the reality is, how many times in history did we succumb? So the people said, enough. Showing genug shon, as they say. We're willing to forgo the reward and we'll get rid of the idolatry.
How did they know exactly what the reward was? You don't know what the reward for any
It doesn't tell us. So I'm going to leave the question of what the reward is open. For now, I'm going to leave it as a simple explanation, the simplest, which is that the reward, simply the, whatever the reward that God gives us is for not committing a sin. I think I have a more sophisticated explanation of it, but we need to finish the passage first. Immediately, nafal lehu pitka mirakia, dahavi katav ba emet, a petek, a note, fell from heaven. And on this note was written the word truth, meaning, what happened?
Deal.
God said, deal. God said, you got it. At the moment the people said, will forgo the reward, get rid of idolatry, and with Michael Zionist, I say, we'll get rid of the reward. We'll forgo it. So God agreed. And that, from here, we see that the seal of God, the stamp of God, the seal, of the signature of God is truth. That's a separate piece, not for now. So what did they do? Utivu b'ta'anita tlata yomin v'tlata leluata. They sat in fasting for 3 days and three nights. Masruhu nihalayu, and God gave it over to them. What's the it? The yetzer, let's call it the yetzer for idolatry, the desire for idolatry. If we could personify every type of sin with a different yetzer hara, so it would be the yetzer hara for idolatry, to put it into vernacular that we're familiar with. How? Nafak ata kiguria denura mi bet kochei kodeshim. It emerged as a fiery lion from the Holy of Holies. Now, there's two images there that we need to bear in mind. One is the notion of the Yetzer for Avodah Zarah described as a fiery lion. That's a powerful image. The second is the source. Where is that fiery lion emerging from? The Holy of Holies. That's also an interesting observation. Its meaning we'll come back to. Amar lehu Navi Yisrael. The Navi said to Israel. Who is the Navi? So there are three Navim contemporary to Sefer, to that period of time. Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi. The last of them being Malachi. So the Rashi says, Rashi says it was Zechariah, but it's one or the other, Zechariah or Malachi, meaning one of the last Nevi'im, who happens to be part of the time period of the men of the Great Assembly on Shekneset HaGdola, beginning of the Second Temple. He is there, he's part of that group, and the Navi spoke to them and said, Hainu Yitzrad Avodah Zarah. This fiery lion emerging from the Holy of Holies, says the Navi, I recognize it. That's the Yetzer for idolatry. And why I need a Navi to tell them that the fiery lion emerging from the Holy of Holies is the Yetzer for Avodah Zarah after they've been sitting and fasting for 3 days for just this thing is an interesting issue. We'll leave it out. Shenemar, as it says, Omar Zot Harisha. Pasuk from Zechariah, that's the evil. He points to it and he says, that's the evil. So then they have a technical problem, which I'm going to skip for now. They grabbed it and it ran away from them. It escaped them. It roared and they were all thrust back 400 parsa. They didn't know what to do. So the Navi gave them an etzah. He told them a solution of how to kill this thing. Amalu Navi skipped a line. Shadyuhu bududa da avra v'chafyu lepume ba'avra. Stick it in hot lead and pour hot lead down its throat, and that'll absorb and it'll destroy it. And he quotes a pasuk from Zechariah. Again, there's a whole dialogue from pasukim from Zechariah, because he's the local contemporary Navi, of how to destroy the Yetzer for Avodah Zarah. And with that, they do, and so ends the Yetzer for Avodah Zarah. In other words, what the Gemara is suggesting, in a very graphic and very colorful way, is that idolatry didn't end by accident. Idolatry ended because we agreed to end it. We entered into a negotiated settlement with the Ribono Shel Olam to end idolatry and to forego the reward of idolatry, which has yet to be defined. That God said, fine, out popped this fiery lion from the Holy of Holies, and the Navi stood there and said, ah, you see, you got it. That's the Yetzer for Avodah Zarah. They took it, they shechted it. They shechted it. With hot lead poured down its throat. Done. And from that point forward, there's no more idolatry in the world. The Yetzer for Avodah Zarah is gone. So says the Gemara. Omru, they said, now they have a great deal going. They prayed to God to get rid of one of the major sins of the society, and God agreed. It's a great deal. Can you imagine what we could do with such a deal? Spend 3 days and three nights praying for the end of, Chilul Shabbos. And it'll be gone. That'll be the end of it.
Why did forgo the reward? What's wrong with that?
Okay, so I have to come back. We have still have to come back to the reward. What is this reward? I'll come back to it.
What, but why, whatever it is, why to forgo it?
Why do they need to forgo it? Fair question. The next passage is really interesting. Amru, they said, Ha'il ve'et ratzonhu nebayet achamei ayitzra de'avera. Since this is a time of grace, time of rachamim, it's a great deal. The Rebbeinu Shlom is giving us whatever we want. Right? So let's keep going. We've got rid of idolatry. What's next on our list? What's the next biggest avera in the world after idolatry? What's the biggest avera in the world after idolatry?
Well, they picked adultery.
Adultery. Adultery, infidelity. Right? Unless, of course, you come from England. Unless you come from England. Anybody here from England? My parents once told me that when they lived in England, there was a study done, and it was published in the local British whatever paper it was, that they had done a survey of Britons on what was the priority of the worst social transgressions, worst social crimes. And next to murder, the next one was cue jumping.
All right. And they'll kill you if you cue jump.
Cue jumping. And then adultery. Right. Cue jumping first, adultery second. So if you're from England and you were there, then you would have said, oh, let's get rid of cue jumping.
What reward do you give up?
I have no idea. That's a good question. But they weren't from England, thank God. They were from Babel, or Persia, or Israel in this case. And they decided to try their hand at getting rid of adultery.
What happened if they did X, Y, or Z jumping?
X, Y, or Z. Ba'ur hachamei ve'imser bi'adayim. So they asked, they prayed, the Rebbeinu Shlom should have mercy, and he gave it over to them. So now they've got their hands, they got rid of the Yetzer for Avodah Zarah, now they've got their hands on the Yetzer for adultery. Amar Luhu, he said to them, who is he?
Navi.
Excuse me?
Navi?
The Navi. Remember the Navi? Remember the dialogue of the Navi?
Yeah.
When they got the Yetzer for Avodah Zarah, it emerged from the Holy of Holies as a fiery lion, and the Navi stood there and he said, Amar Lehu Navi. The Navi said to them, that's it. So now the Navi standing there with them, Amar Lehu, he said to them, Chazu, careful. Watch yourself. Ikatlitu Leilahu, if you kill this one, Kalya Alma, the world will be destroyed. You kill this one, the world will be destroyed. So now there is a dilemma. It was easy to get rid of idolatry. Now they tried with adultery, and the Navi said, not so fast. You destroy this one, and you will destroy the world. So they decided to try an experiment. Chavshuhu tlata yome. They locked it up for 3 days. They took the Yetzer, the desire, the drive for adultery, and they locked it up for 3 days. And then they started their experiment. After 3 days, they went on a quest. Ubau bi'ata bat yuma b'chol eretz Yisrael lo yishtakach. They went searching for a single fresh-laid egg, and they could not find even one. Amre, they said, Hechin Avid, what are we going to do? Naktale, if we destroy this Yetzer for adultery, Kalya Alma will destroy the world. So nibai rachame apalga, and to ask God for half, destroy adultery, but don't destroy the other half, whatever the other half is. Come back. Palga b'dekiyaleyave. God doesn't give halves. It's all or nothing. So what do they do? Kachlinu le'enei v'shavkuhu v'ahanidu le'mikre be'le'inish be'krifta. They blinded it somewhat, and it helped a little bit, in as much as man no longer entices, it no longer entices man to commit incest. Incest is as a powerful social force is much less common than it would otherwise have been. Forgetting the issue of the incest for a moment, what's going on in this passage? What is going on? What's going on? Locked up for 3 days, couldn't find chickens laying eggs.
So now they say that it would destroy reproduction if you destroyed this Yetzer Hara.
Right. What the Navi is saying is if you destroy the Yetzer Hara for adultery, you will also destroy the drive or the desire for reproduction.
Why?
And you can't do that. It'll destroy the world. So they said, well, let's take it halfway. Let's destroy adultery and not destroy reproduction. Let's go halfway. Says the Gemara, Palga Bisham Berakia Lo Yave. God doesn't give halves. Why not? He did for adultery. He did for idolatry.
Did he?
Well, that's the question. Did he? God doesn't give halves. What's going on here? So let's deal with the latter piece of it first, because I think that's easier to understand. What's essentially going on?
There's a flip side. There's like a benefit that you kind of want from this inclination that's a bad inclination.
Correct. There's a benefit. In other words, let me reframe it. I've been very careful not to talk about the word Yetzer as a Yetzer Hara. I actually have great difficulty with the phrase Yetzer Hara. The Gemara doesn't talk about Yetzer Hara here. The Gemara talks about Yetzer. The Yetzer for idolatry, the Yetzer for adultery, the Yetzer. Why? Because what the Gemara is essentially saying is that there's really no such thing as a Yetzer HaTov and a Yetzer Hara in this regard. It's not a good inclination or a bad inclination. It's a part of the physical reality in which we live. There's a drive for sexuality, let's call it in the second passage. Channeled correctly, it will lead one to marriage, reproduction, family, children. God created the world to be settled and to be populated and to expand. That's part of the natural and positive order of the world. Channeled incorrectly, allowed to be unbridled, and it will lead one to all kinds of sexual crimes and sins, including the expressions such as infidelity and adultery and everything that comes with it. We call the generic term in Hebrew Gilui Arayot. In other words, the Gemara recognizes the fact that there's no such thing as a good inclination or bad inclination. There's a physical drive. It's an inclination. Now the question is how you channel it. And to every negative for every positive phenomenon, there's a negative phenomenon. It's all a question of how you channel it. You know, there's a fascinating passage in the Gemara about it's a story with the wife of Rav Nachman. His name is Yalta. Gemara says that Yalta came to the sages and said, you know, we have a phenomenon in the Torah where every prohibited thing has a parallel permissible thing. At any time the Torah prohibits something, it permits something of similar style. It's a balance. So, for example, the Torah prohibits the eating of blood. The Torah allows for the eating of liver, which contains blood. The Torah prohibits, and she gives a whole series of examples. So the Torah prohibits incest, but the Torah permits yibum, which is levirate marriage with one's sister-in-law or brother-in-law, in the case of a deceased husband without child.
Different.
It's different, but there you see there's a balance. There's a balance. What she's saying is there is a balance in all of halacha. So in that particular passage, she turns to the chachamim and she says, I want to taste milk and meat. Blood, prohibited. It's permissible in the context of liver. She cites another example. She says, I want to taste what milk and meat taste like. So where is it permissible? So they said to her, you're not going to like this one, but all right, we're after dinner. We're okay. We're well after dinner. She said, fine, you want to eat milk and meat together? Go consume the udder of a cow. Because until the milk emerges from the cow, it's not milk. So the udder of a cow, which is filled with milk, is actually parv. Well, the meat, the udder is meat, and the milk is no status, or it's parv, or it's actually flesh. So therefore, you want to cook meat and milk together and consume it. You don't need to go to the soy meat and the cheese, or the soy cheese and the meat. You can just go to the udder of a cow and you get milk and meat together. There's a parallel. That's an example on a different level. But here, much more concrete, the Gemara says you can't destroy adultery without destroying procreation. And that observation was pointed out to them by the Navi. So now if that's true, let's go back one step. And this is the vort of the Vilna Gaon. On this Gemara, the Vilna Gaon has an unbelievable insight, very powerful insight. He says, let's go back one step. If that assumption is true, that every negative phenomenon is essentially the expression of an unbridled force with a positive expression, adultery opposite procreation. You destroy one, you destroy the other. Then, if I go back to idolatry, so there had to have been some positive force parallel to idolatry that we would have had if channeled properly. In other words, if I take that same passage and I assume it backwards, then just as adultery parallels procreation, idolatry has to parallel something else. And that means that when I gave up idolatry, I had to be willing to give up something else.
Not to give up.
To give up. Mm-hmm. I go back to the same story. Take the second passage and work it through to the first passage. In the second passage, we had adultery opposite procreation. They're both expressions, positive and negative expressions of the same desire, the same drive.
Right.
What you can get rid of is not the symptom, but the cause, the drive. And then you get rid of both, positive and negative phenomena at the same time. So you can't do that with procreation because you'll destroy the world. You can do that, says the Gemara, with idolatry. And we did do it with idolatry. That, says the Vilna Gaon, was the reward the Gemara was talking about. Remember when they said, the idolatry, you only gave us idolatry for its reward. What's the reward? So we interpreted the reward as being the abstinence from idolatry. Says the Vilna Gaon, no. It's not the reward that we get because we abstained from idolatry. The reward the Gemara was talking about was the flip side, the positive phenomenon that the drive for idolatry could create.
Closeness to Hashem.
Well, that's very generic, but we're getting closer. We're getting closer. In other words, assuming that what we're dealing with is not the yetzer for idolatry, but the yetzer, the drive for something, let's call it for a tangible relationship
it's
with God,
idolatry.
Then channeled incorrectly, it leads to idolatry. Channeled correctly, it leads to something else. That something else was the reward the Gemara spoke about when it said that you only gave us idolatry for its reward, meaning for the flip side. Said the people, after 1,000 years, we will forego that reward. We are prepared to give it up. Whatever it is, we are prepared to give it up. And God said, okay. Immediately, after 3 days, it emerged as a fiery lion. What's the symbolism of a fiery lion? The fire, let's leave for a moment. What's the symbolism of the lion? What does a lion represent?
Power.
Power. Strength. an overwhelming power, a seductive power. And it emerged from the Holy of Holies. Why from the Holy of Holies? Says the Vilna Gaon. Historically, when we lost idolatry, the Gemara is pointing to a period of time when idolatry ended, beginning of the Second Temple. If this is holds true, then something must have ended with it. Whatever positive phenomenon is the opposite of idolatry had to have ended at that time too. What was it? Well, what's the opposite of idolatry? What's the opposite expression of a tangible, physical relationship with an object that we define as God? Says the Vilna Gaon, prophecy.
Mm-hmm. So Nivur. We gave up prophecy.
Right. Nivur. Because what is Nevuah? Again, if Nevuah is defined just as a message God communicates to man, then it has nothing to do with idolatry. But if the Rambam, as we said in the Rambam, if idolatry is a, if prophecy is first and foremost a connection to the, in the Rambam's terminology, the active intellect, it is a connection to God, it's an experiential relationship with God, it's a tangible one. The Rambam described the physical overwhelming power that prophecy has. It literally saps you of your energy. It's almost like a trance. It's a physical, almost like a physical, tangible connection to God. If the drive to have a relationship with God is so great, is so powerful, is so tangible, that on the one end, if you channel that correctly, that's the drive that would lead a person to the Rambam's description of the efforts that one has to go to reach a level of prophecy. If channeled incorrectly, it leads to the shortcuts. And the shortcuts is, instead of elevating the human being to reach the level where it can connect to God, you reduce God to the level of the human being. It's the shortcut. You circumvent the process. But the two phenomena are exactly the opposites of each other. And historically, the period of idolatry is the period of prophecy. Hmm. When idolatry ended, prophecy ended. It doesn't happen overnight. It's a process that takes about 100 years. But during that 100 years, especially through the Babylonian exile, when we come back from the Babylonian exile, for all intents and purposes, prophecy is dying out. You have three more prophets, and then it's gone. Chagah, Zechariah, Malachi, holdovers from the previous time, and then prophecy is gone. So is idolatry. And the fort of the Vilna Gaon is that they disappear together.
So it was set up like that?
So the Gemara seems to say it was intentional. We were willing to give up the reward of prophecy in order to remove the power of idolatry. From a sociological point of view, I can point to certain phenomena that swept through history at that period of time that played a role in that kind of change, transformation. The most powerful of them being the story of Purim. Timely. Right? Why the story of Purim? Because Gemara says, There's a parak in Tehillim, Mizmor LaYelet HaShachar, Psalm of the Morning Dawn. And the Gemara says that psalm is essentially the story of Purim. To which the Gemara asks the question, why is Esther compared to the dawn? And the Gemara answers, because just as the dawn is the end of night, Ma Shachar, Sof Kol HaLaila, so Esther is the end of miracles. So you'll say to me, wait a second, end of miracles is supposed to be a good thing? It's a bad thing. Gemara says it's the dawn of a new era. The period of miracles is a period of darkness. The end of miracles is a period of light. How does that work? Well, miracles, prophecy, idolatry, they're all interconnected. They're all physical manifestations of God's presence in the world. And what Purim did was it demonstrated a relationship with God that did not need to have open intervention, supernatural engagement to have redemption. It changed the paradigm of redemption. The paradigm of redemption we've always had up until that point was Yetziat Mitzrayim. So every time we got into trouble, we looked for another Yetziat Mitzrayim, 10 plagues type of thing. Purim changed that. Purim brings into the equation the notion of a natural relationship with God. Less tangible, less obvious, less pinpointable, less fire and brimstone, but more lasting. Subtle, lower key, but no idolatry. No prophecy, but no idolatry.
What do you do at the end of the day, like when Mashiach comes, and Eliyahu comes
Mashiach
back?
Is a king in Israel, says the Rambam. No, nothing will change. We'll get to that when we get to principle number 12.
And Eliyahu coming back, he's a prophet, right? Doesn't he presage the coming of Mashiach?
Yeah.
He's from the floor.
But we'll talk to that when we get to the Rambam's 12th principle. But this is the power of this. And the Vilna Gaon has one more observation, and he goes to this Gemara, points out a number of nuances that now make a lot of sense. Why is the Yetzer Hara for idolatry emerging from the Holy of Holies?
Because it's the connection with God.
What else emerged? What else is centered in the Holy of Holies? What else is situated in the Holy of Holies? The Ark, and therefore?
And the tablet.
The tablets, and therefore,
the Kruvim,
and the Kruvim, and therefore,
God
we're getting
himself.
Closer. No,
nope.
We're getting closer. The Kruvim,
oh,
and therefore,
the
we're getting closer.
With God.
The communication is the source of prophecy. Uvevo Moshe o Moed, Vayishmat Kol Elokim Mideber Le Miben Shnei Kruvim Asher LaKaporet Asher LaRona Edut. When Moshe would enter into the Moed, he would hear the voice of God emanating from between the Kruvim upon the Aron. The voice of God, the source of prophecy, is the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The Gemara says the reason why we didn't have prophecy in the Second Temple period is because we didn't have the Ark. And without the Ark, the power pack of the Temple, you've silenced the communication. We didn't have any of the miracles that took place in the First Temple, because all those miracles, including prophecy, required the Ark. It was the power pack to the Temple. Well, that was required, but if you had that power pack and you had all those miracles, you also had idolatry. And what the Gemara finally understood, what Chazal finally understood, was that they're connected. The reason they had idolatry was because they had prophecy, and because they had miracles, because they kept seeing a manifestation of God's presence. So it's like being on drugs. You'll pardon the analogy. It feels great for the moment, but what happens when you're finished? What happens when the miracle stops?
You want more.
And you want more and you don't have it, then you have to create it. And before you know it, now you're back to idolatry. How long did the story of the revelation at Sinai last? How long did the impact of the revelation at Sinai last? 40 days. And we were worshiping a golden calf. That's not an accident. Because the intense experience of prophecy has to be maintained, or it will lead to the intense experience of idolatry. The last observation in the Gemara, if you remember when they killed the Eitzer for Avodah Zarah, the next passage begins, they said, okay, we got a great thing going, let's get rid of idolatry. Let's get rid of adultery. The next line in the Gemara says, Amar Lahu, he said to them. And I asked you who the he was. And the answer is? The Navi. So first of all, what did the Navi interject here for? The answer is because the Navi understood what was at stake. Second of all, in the first paragraph it says, Amar Lahu Navi. The Navi said to Israel. In the second paragraph it says, Amar Lahu, he said to them. What happened to the title Navi?
Not a Navi anymore.
Says the Vilna Gaon, he's not a Navi anymore. Nobody understood the price that they would pay for getting rid of idolatry more than the Navi. Mm. The Navi led them down that first path because the Navi understood it. He understood the price that it had to be paid. The second half, they couldn't do it. Come back to the question with which, now you asked me a question at the beginning. So what was the drive for idolatry? Now I think you have an answer, a longer, more elaborate, but I think an answer to that question. It was part of a whole culture, a whole societal structure that was driven to relationship with God as the primary motivating force of everything that happened. Channeled correctly, and you could reach incredible heights. More often than not, unfortunately, it was channeled incorrectly and brought God down into your domain, into the world of idolatry.
If channeled correctly, it would be prophecy, so why it should disappear both?
You can't have one without the other. You can't have one without the other. Ideally, if every single person is able to channel it correctly, but the reality of 1,000 years was that they weren't able to do it, so they were willing to give it up.
But Hashem said, if you give up idolatry, I'll give you a reward.
No,
so he
no. That's not how we're reading the Gemara. That's how we originally read the Gemara. But what the Vilna Gaon is saying is that the reward is not that God is going to reward us for not doing idolatry. The reward the Gemara is talking about is that equation, that flip side, that fact that every negative has a positive. The reward is the positive manifestation of that experience. The reward here that we're talking about is prophecy. Not that God rewards them, but that the existence of idolatry also has a positive side. It's the positive side called prophecy.
And they're willing to give that up.
And that's what the people were willing to give up.
Without knowing that, like, why they would want to give it up if it was a matter of choice, why they would choose to give it up?
Because they just come back from the destruction of the temple and the Babylonian exile. They, for 1,000 years, idolatry was the overwhelming force in society, so they decided to give it up.
No, not the idolatry. Why they would choose to give up the reward?
You can't have one without the other.
Yeah, the idolatry was causing so much trouble, they were willing to...
You can't have one without the other. They recognize that.
They just didn't want idolatry anymore.
You can't have one without the other. They made it... It's a cost-benefit analysis. They decided that the benefit does not outweigh the cost. In simple terms, yeah.
I was going to guess that they were ready to give up Korbanot, which is a physical relationship with Hashem, and which we don't have now.
They don't have that right.
But they...
They don't have that right. Korbanot are a mitzvah in the Torah. They don't have the right to give up a mitzvah in the Torah.
So during the second Beit HaMikdash, we had Korbanot fully because it was a mitzvah in the Torah.
Absolutely required.
It's not the part that they were giving up.
They don't have the right to give up a mitzvah in the Torah. They're not changing the Torah. And arbitrarily mix and match and say, okay, well, we're going to get rid of these whole sections of laws. They don't have that right. Other religious systems did that, but Torah doesn't allow.
So when they gave up prophecy, they gave up the communication concept, but could there be a righteous person who could still reach that level of without...
Ruach HaKodesh, yes, but Ruach HaKodesh is not Nevuah. Right, it's a level below Nevuah. That's why I think I mentioned at the very beginning that the Rambam writes that Ruach HaKodesh is the step right before Nevuah, and Ruach HaKodesh is attainable. Nevuah is not. The moment Nevuah closed, it closed. Period.
So you can't get the Vayera concept?
Nope.
It's just gone.
Because that's the opposite of Avodah Zarah. It's exactly what we're talking about.
I can't explain it very well, but the first time when we talked about idolatry, you mentioned also that the thing that happened with idolatry is you could explain bad, because you had all these different aspects or different gods. So there's a good God and a bad God, but when you only have one God,
then everything has one source. Back to principle number two.
We watched a movie on the recommendation of somebody called God on Trial. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, no.
It takes place in the Holocaust, but some of the arguments had to do with all the miracles that had happened previously in Jewish history. So if that was true, then why weren't there... Remember that kind of thing? Why? Because
they were looking for the... They were prisoners in Auschwitz, and
right.
there was a selection.
This would be a good
then,
time, you know, if God was really good, like, why not
how
another
could this
miracle?
Be?
If those were really true. Uh-huh. But if you really know this, and I think that's her sadness, is, you know, that there isn't going to be a miracle. Like
well,
that.
There's still divine intervention. There's still God's presence
we could
in
get
history,
a big miracle for
but
you
not know? Supernatural. There's a difference. The Purim story was also God's involvement, but not supernatural.
The allies could have liberated Auschwitz.
Right?
That.
But
no,
people,
it's God,
people had to
God
do something.
God moves from the open to the hidden. It still operates, but moves from the open to the hidden.
I think a lot of the like the sadnesses or like the doubts or the you know the weak that people have in our day is that you know that you don't have that open communication and that somebody can really say what's what God wants or
yeah, well God and moves,
sad.
So that's
sad.
I understand. Well, we're not going to solve the issue of theology of theodicy, but this passage, what this coming back to the question I asked at the beginning of the shiur is why is prophecy a principle of faith? If I leave out the message piece of it for a moment, remember that the notion of prophecy as a message is ultimately the next principle, principle number 7. Why is prophecy as a concept by and of itself deserving of a status amongst the 13 principles of faith? I think the answer is because it's the opposite of idolatry. In other words, if in the structure of the 13 principles, the Rambam first establishes the notion of a relationship that God has with the world. We talked about that schematic, if you will, principles 1 through 4. God exists, he's the creator, he's one, source of everything, beyond time, outside of physicality, etc. He enters into our domain and has a relationship with us. We now have to have a relationship back. That relationship has to be reciprocal. How? Now, the answer to how gets bifurcated. How splits into two, namely, correctly and incorrectly. How do we serve God? How do we have a relationship with God? Well, there's two possibilities. Correctly, that relationship channels and leads to prophecy as an experience, not as a message, as an experience, as a reward. Channeled incorrectly, that relationship leads to idolatry. Before we destroyed the Eitzer for idolatry, in the concept of the Torah, you will serve God relates to man relates to God. How? Well, if correctly, it'll lead you to the greatest heights, prophecy. Channeled incorrectly, it'll lead you to the greatest depths, idolatry. Always get the two mixed up. Idolatry. Now the only question is, how do you define correctly and incorrectly? Well, the answer to that is, I need some guidance. I need some definition, some criteria that will determine what is correct relationship with God and what is incorrect relationship with God. What will lead me down the path to idolatry and what will lead me towards the path to prophecy? The answer to that is that information can only come from one source, namely God. Only God can tell me how that relationship is to manifest itself. If I try to define that relationship on my terms, well, that's what idolatry is. It's defining God on my terms. Defining God on God's terms is prophecy. So I need a communication mechanism. I need prophecy. I need a nevuah. I need a revelation to tell me the right and the wrong mechanism for serving God. And that's why the next principle is the notion of the prophecy of Moshe. It's critical. I can't go anywhere without the communication of my two extremes, my two poles, prophecy and idolatry. Those are my two poles. The definition of what leads to one versus the other is whether I serve God on God's terms or on my terms. And for that I need prophecy. But that I need a message, a communication. I need a Torah to tell me. And that leads me to principle number 7. So the way I understand these first six principles is the first four define God's relationship to man. The next two, prophecy and idolatry, are both part of the balance of man's relationship to God. And now I'm ready to understand the need for communication of the Torah, revelation of the Torah, to tell me how I'm supposed to serve God. What is the proper prescription, to use the analogy of the Kuzari? And that brings us to principle number seven, which, Bezrat Hashem, we will begin next week.
You know, still have with the other religions who think they have their prophecy also. I mean, and obviously we don't hold with them, but like you've got Islam, which says you can send your child out and is a suicide bomber, and it's just lucky, right? I mean,
some aspects of fundamentals Islam, not all, but that notwithstanding, we'll get to that when we talk about prophecy. Okay.